BBC Radio 3 brings you one of the hottest tickets of the year, the Royal Opera's Tosca with Bryn Terfel, Jonas Kaufmann and Angela Gyulkyu. And for once, the critics were just as appreciative. The stars were shining, they said, the chemistry unmistakable, this Tosca was tasty and then some. Opera on 3 brings you everything from first note to last, together with interviews with the stars and a look behind the opera. Saturday night at 6 o'clock on BBC Radio 3.
Well, now it's just gone 12 o'clock and time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
The novelist and poet Simon Moore writes with a piercing elegance, and that has won him many admirers for books like The Fall, which centres round his passion for climbing, Swimming to Ithaca, much inspired by his childhood experiences of Cyprus, and The Glass Room, which has won several prizes. It was published in 2009 and was shortlisted for the Booker Prize. In that novel, and indeed others, order becomes subverted in a way that mirrors not only human relationships, but also politics and history, particularly so in The Glass Room.
Yes, The Glass Room gives an account of the lives of people, but hugely influenced by the environment in which they're living, the political world of Middle Europe in the 1920s, 1930s, where everybody was victim of outside circumstances.
You mention music quite often in your writing, so it's obviously important to you.
Yes, it is, although I have to do a very hasty piece of sort of stepping back. I am no musician. In fact, it's one of the two things that I'm sort of ashamed of, is my lack of formal knowledge of music and my lack of formal knowledge of mathematics.
Well, let me reassure you that we do not require any mathematics, and the programme is called Private Passions, so you can be revealed in all your nakedness without any fear. The first music is by a composer who, for the time, I think had quite an extraordinary vision in a way. One listens to the music and feels it's very original.
Yes, she was visionary. I mean, she literally had visions.
This is Hildegard of Bingen.
Hildegard of Bingen, indeed. And her visions, which she drew in the margin of some of her works, her writing, she actually drew pictures of what she saw, and they are migraine auras. And so it seems likely that she actually was a migraine sufferer. I'm a fellow migraine sufferer, so I don't interpret them as being the city of God, which I think is what she did.
When you hear the music, we're going to hear Columba Aspexit, do you feel that that element that you just described creeps into it?
It's a sort of perfect exemplar of medieval religious faith. It's absolutely wonderful, and that's the sort of faith that I can understand as a novelist. One tries to empathise, and I can see what it meant in those days, because they're so far from us and our modern perceptions and ideas. And yet you listen to something like this and you can get into the medieval mind, I feel. It is a prayer.
Oh,
quite fascinating, the combination of a sort of plain chant-like line and a sort of drone.
The drone, yes.
Which I think is called Symphony, provided by Doreen Musket there. We heard Emma Kirkby with Gothic Voices, and that was Columba Aspexit by Hildegard of Bingen. We always talk about dearth of, for many centuries, of women composers, but actually she was one of the first composers of all.
There she is, yes.
I don't know whether faith plays an important part in your life, living in Rome, and you've now got a Kyrie coming up, but that doesn't necessarily mean anything, of course.
No. Shall I say it used to? I mean, I am very moved by religious music, religious art, but I'm not a believer. I have been a Catholic. I was a convert, in fact.
That's very fascinating because there are so many great pieces of art that have been created by people who don't necessarily believe. And it raises an interesting sort of philosophical question, which is, do you need to believe in order to create works that move other people to religious fervour?
I'm sure not. There's a degree to which, I don't want to demean it, because in a way, a rather humble way, I'm an artist, but there's trickery to art, actually. And
artifice.
Absolutely. And of course, Mozart, and the next piece coming up is Mozart, was a quintessential example who could go from a mass in one moment to sort of farce in another.
Which movement from the great mass in C minor have you chosen?
It's the Kyrie Eleison.
the Kyrie Eleison from the Great Mass in C minor, Kirkel 427, by Mozart. Sylvia McNair was the soprano soloist with the Monteverdi Choir, the English Baroque Soloists, conducted by Sir John Eliot Gardner. There were moments in that which were so quintessentially Mozart. One thinks of that long line unfolding in the Christe with the soloist. And in the Kyrie section, there's a harmonic moment where we both have looked at each other. And it's just because you know that that is something which speaks to you in a quite different way.
Yes. Yet working always within the sort of classical tradition, because, of course, just round the corner, the whole romantic movement is going to happen.
I mean, in one sense, Simon Moore, I think our next composer, Janáček, and especially in this music, stepped beyond the confines of structure, that the music has a kind of freedom. You feel he's inventing his own method of thinking almost.
Yes, and it's the piano music as well, which, of course, which I love, but he, of course, is, I suppose, most celebrated as a composer of opera and orchestral pieces. And then there are these very distinctive piano pieces that he wrote.
And in fact, he plays quite a role at moments in your writing. And I thought it'd be nice just to get a taste of how you work this in. And also it gives us a flavour of the book, The Glass Room. Perhaps you could just set up the moment and then read a little bit into this reference.
Yes, this is midway through the book, in fact, at this moment, and it's about Victor and Cataline, who is his mistress, and talking about the relationship between them and the way they act in each other's company, because there is, of course, also Victor's wife around, Liesel. It wasn't the way that Victor and Cataline looked at each other. It was the way they didn't look. It wasn't the notes. It was the silences between the notes. Some music is the very enemy of silence, keeping the sounds coming so that the listener has no time to reflect. But other music, the music she played for herself, was different. In that music, the music of Janáček, for example, the silences matter. They are silences of foreboding, anticipatory echoes of the sounds that are yet to come.
Thank you.
think it's interesting that silence and the space is very much the prerogative of the mature composer and artist, that have the confidence. And it's like a great actor too, isn't it? That you have the space, you don't feel you've got to fill every minute moment.
Yes, I'm intrigued to consider how that comes into writing a novel, actually, seeing it from my point of view. I think possibly it's letting the reader do some of the work and also leaving things unsaid.
Exactly.
Which is important, and I think one just has to work on instinct. And I don't think I did in my earlier books. I think I said much more, maybe, than I need.
A blown-away leaf from On the Overgrown Path, Book 1 by Janáček, played by Leif Ove Andsnes. Dada,
yes,
is our next subject, and I think you're rather keen on this.
It's a huge contrast, the music. I mean, a total contrast from our previous pieces, which have been slow and meditative and thoughtful, and this piece is not. It's brilliant. Yes, I mean, I do see Dada as extraordinarily interesting and extraordinarily important, because almost 100% of contemporary art, I mean, now contemporary art, is doing what Dada influenced by, completely.
And in terms of composers, who do you feel most epitomises this?
Well, the one I've chosen is George Antheil, who isn't very well known, but there is an extraordinary story connected with him. This piece is written actually for a piece of film art by Fernand Léger, which is quite remarkable. Antheil, as one would as a good Dada artist, got carried away with them, and he wrote it far too long. We obviously are only going to hear a bit of it, but the film, I think, lasts for 16 minutes, and the piece goes on way past 20. In its entirety.
It's quite a Dadaist idea in itself.
Yes, completely, yes. That marvellous stuff, an almost unlimited number of pianolas all sort of playing together, and an absolutely extraordinary story. George Antheil, who was a pianist, in fact, and wrote this piece, was an American, and in 1942, I think, met Hedy Lamarr, at a party in New York, and she had had as a husband, she'd run away from him. He had been an arms dealer, the husband, her husband. Antile and she got talking, and they spent a lot of time intensely after this party together. And they designed a system for communicating between naval ships and torpedoes, radio control of torpedoes. And the idea was to use the pianola roll to change the frequency of the transmission and the reception by the torpedo of the controlling message simultaneously. And this was patented, was immediately made top secret by the US Navy and therefore disappeared. And it was revived in the 1960s when electronics had caught up. And it became spread spectrum transmission, which is the basis for all our mobile phones. All the modern telecommunications are based on this system of frequency flipping. Most extraordinary.
We heard Ivan Davis playing the piano. Rex Lawson operated the pianola. And the new Palais Royal Orchestra and Percussion Ensemble was directed by Maurice Perez in Ballet Mécanique by George Antile. Actually, the title, Ballet Mécanique, that was so suggestive. And of course, it does have that feel to it, doesn't it?
Yes, quite intentionally. The sort of machine futurist sort of thing that Dada had picked up on.
That, Simon Moore, one could not say about our next music.
No. No. The contrast, again, couldn't be greater, but it is good throwing Ballet Mécanique in the middle.
That's true. The music that we are going to hear is, again, the piano, but it is, in a sense, almost the apotheosis of the abstract form in some ways, isn't it?
Yes, and this has always struck me about music. As somebody who works as a writer within forms that are imposed, obviously, by the language you're writing completely, and if you become an abstract avant-garde writer, you just end up with Finnegan's Wake, which everybody sort of reveres and nobody reads.
Do you think in that case, I'm interested in this subject, and I ask lots of people who come on to Private Passions, I mean, do you subscribe to the sort of Adorno adage that most artists aspire to the condition of music?
Yes, because unless you've got a programmatic piece of music where you're trying to do something that sounds like something which is so limited, you're really in the world of abstraction, and you always have been.
And I think that's very true with this Beethoven piano sonata in C minor. When you hear this movement, where does it take you, since we're talking about sort of subjectivity?
Yes, that's difficult because it's the abstract. As far as I can remember, this is the first piece of instrumental music with the human voice is different. As soon as you put the human voice in...
Or text.
Yes, you've got emotion being communicated to you one way or another. But I identify this as the first piece of music that moved me to tears, that I sat and listened to. And, of course, this particular movement is very long. We're only going to hear some of it, unfortunately. I remember sitting and it moving me to tears, and it's a series of notes. Thank you. seems wrong not to let it go on.
It seems awful, but that's, I'm afraid, one of the constraints of the programme. But it does seem awful also because actually here is a composer, as you're suggesting, who you sense is extending the form, is overriding, you know, form. And so therefore it makes it particularly difficult to stop, but because you realise that you're being taken on a journey which is surmounting hurdles and going further.
Yes, completely revolutionary.
That was the beginning of the second movement of the Beethoven Piano Sonata in C minor, Opus 111, played by Daniel Barenboim. Another change of mood, actually, Simon, and this one, I think, very much to do with your love of different places and what that prompts, the colours and the smell.
Yes, well, the next piece is Panam, which is Paris. A rather curious term for Paris, whose origins, I think, are obscure, but might have something to do with Panama hats, although I can't quite see the connection. But it's a city that I love. It's easy, I think, to love Paris. This is actually a song that is about the real Paris. It's very much a song about the Paris that the casual visitor doesn't see and doesn't experience. In fact, it says as much.
Paname. On t'a chanté sur tous les tons. Y a plein de paroles dans tes chansons qui parlent de qui, de quoi donc, Paname. Paname. Moi, c'est tes yeux. Moi, c'est ta peau que je veux baiser comme il faut, comme savent baiser les gigolos. Panin, soleil a mis son pyjama, toi tu t'allumes et dans tes bas, y a Monsieur Haussmann qui te fait du plat. Panam, et viens m'aimer comme autrefois, la nuit surtout, quand toi et moi, on marchait vers, on ne savait quoi. Paname, y a des noms de rues que l'on oublie. C'est dans ces rues qu'après minuit, tu me faisais voir ton petit Paris. Paname, quand tu chialais dans tes klaxons, perdu là-bas parmi les hommes, tu venais vers moi comme une vraie môme. Paname, ce soir j'ai envie de danser, de danser avec tes pavés, que le monde regarde avec ses pieds. Paname, t'es belle tu sais sous tes lampions, des fois quand tu pars en saison, dans les bras d'un accordéon. Paname, quand tu t'habilles avec du bleu, ça fait sortir les amoureux qui disent à Paris tous les deux. Paname, quand tu t'habilles avec du gris, les couturiers n'ont qu'un souci, c'est de foutre en gris toutes les souris. Paname, quand tu t'ennuies, tu fais les quais, tu fais la Seine et les noyers, ça fait prendre l'air, ça distrait. Paname, c'est fou ce que tu peux faire causer, mais les gens savent pas qui tu es, ils vivent chez toi, mais te vois jamais. Paname, si tu souriais, j'aurais ton charme, si tu pleurais, j'aurais tes larmes. Si on te frappait, je prendrais les armes. Paname, tu n'es pas pour moi qu'un frisson, qu'une idée, qu'une fille à chanson. Et c'est pour ça que je crie ton nom. Paname, Paname. Bye.
Is it immediately conjures up an atmosphere of place and rather pleasant decadence?
Vivid, oh yes, definitely.
There's even a little reference, I noticed, I don't know which way around, to in the instrumental writing, to George Gershwin's An American in Paris, just about two bars. I think somebody might have been having a bit of fun.
A bit of fun putting it in, yes.
Leo Ferré, Paname. Juliet Greco was the singer with André Pop and his orchestra. I suppose the other city that has an element of that, one might say, is Berlin and Weill. And then, of course, where we're going next also has an incredibly strong identity, but in a very different way, and that's New Orleans.
Yes, so the next piece is being played by one of the great New Orleans jazzmen, who, of course, is connected with Paris, who actually, I think, ended his life in France. That makes it sound as if he did it. He died. In France.
He didn't have much choice.
And was part of this sort of movement of very much movement of jazz from New Orleans out into the world via Chicago, New York, and then beyond. And Paris was, of course, one of the first places in Europe where jazz really did take root. And
we're talking about Sidney Bechet. And, of course, this also has Duke Ellington. Another great.
Who is another major part of the diffusion of jazz and the transformation of jazz.
This is Ellington's Mood Indigo, played by Sidney Bechet and his New Orleans Feet Warmers. Indigo by Duke Ellington. We heard Sidney Bechet and his New Orleans feet warmers. One of the nice things about this programme is that often people like you, Simon Moore, will come on and say, you know, I'm no musicologist, and yet you introduce us to music that we may not know, and that's certainly the case, I suspect, for many people with this last piece. Another musician turns up, well, two, in fact, in the glass room, a composer called Vyteslava Kapralova, who was another woman composer, actually, and whose life was tragically short, and then a fictional pianist. Perhaps you'd just like to tell us a bit about these two characters.
Yes, well, we're in the housewarming party when the house is newly built, the glass room, of course, being the major living room in this house. And the fictional pianist, Niemetz, has just finished playing, and he hands over... This is the sort of delight one has when writing. You can always throw in real people. It's just actually a bit of amusement, but quite significant in that she is, I think, quite an important person.
How did you come across her?
Oh, in the way that one does, in reading around, looking into, nosing into corners, in the research for a book. I knew I wanted to place the people and the circumstances in the sort of intellectual world of Brno in the late 1920s. Who was there? Who? What was? Milan Kundera's father features here. He was teaching at the Brno Conservatoire at that time.
And Kapralova died when she was only 25.
Yes, she died in 1940, tragically, in France. Yeah. It is an extraordinary story, and I mean, that is one of the things that drew me to her particularly, is that there was this extraordinary talent that she clearly had. She was trained in Brno. She then later went on a scholarship, or a series of scholarships, to Paris in the 1930s, the late 1930s. She became protege of Martinu. She then had an affair with him, in fact, and she became significant enough to conduct the BBC Symphony Orchestra in London at the opening of the International Society for Contemporary Music in 1938, playing her military sinfonietta in front of people like Bartok, Hindemith, Britain, who were in the audience. And she was 23, I think. I mean, extraordinarily young.
What happened to her?
She was in Paris at the beginning of the war, slightly on the rebound from Martinu. She actually married, somewhat surprisingly, I think, out of the blue, a young man called Jerzy Mucha, who was the son of Alphonse Mucha, the painter, the Art Nouveau poster work, very famous for, became very popular in the 1960s, those posters. But she suffered a sudden illness, involved severe abdominal pains, just at the time of the invasion of France, the Battle of France. Mucha got her out of Paris just before the Germans occupied the city, down to the south of France. She got as far as Montpellier. I think they were trying to cross into Spain, probably. But she had to be hospitalised there, and she died in hospital in 1940. Very tragic, particularly considering the potential.
Thank you. terrific energy.
Yes, very energetic piece.
That was the first movement, the Allegro Energico indeed, from Vyacheslava Kapralova's Partita for String Orchestra and Piano Opus 20. We heard Jerzy Skovasia playing the piano, the Symphony Orchestra of Brno, conducted by František Jilek. Thank you very much, Simon Moore, for taking us down one or two not frequently travelled byways.
Well, good. Thank you very much for inviting me, but it's nice to know that.
And can we expect another novel soon?
Yes, you can expect another novel towards the beginning of next year.
And I think you've got most of it but the title.
I really have got most of it but the title, yes. It's very much in the sort of, you know, the finished form, all but.
Simon Moore, thank you.
Thank you.
Simon Moore was talking to Michael Barclay. Next week at the same time, Michael's guest on Private Passions will be the theatre director Michael Grandage. That's next Sunday at midday. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3. The producer of today's programme was Chris Marshall.
A new season of Drama on Three continues with one of France's best-kept stage secrets. A playwright as famous as Molière and Racine, but barely performed in the English-speaking world. Tonight, Radio 3 goes back to a golden age of French drama to bring you Pierre Corneille's The Comic Illusion in a new translation for BBC Radio 3 by Ranjit Bolt.
I'll do it in a charming way, as an illusion, like a play performed by spirits who'll assume a human aspect, and by whom each phase, each change your sons pass through, will now be acted out for you.
A comedy of the irreverent and the unexpected, and a new translation making it as fresh as the day it was written. Drama on Three, tonight at 8:30, here on BBC Radio 3.
Well, back to this afternoon. If you've recently tuned in, a very good afternoon to you from me, Jonathan Swain. In a couple of minutes, the early music show, Catherine Botts, joined by harpsichordist Lawrence Cummings, Delma Tomlin, director of the National Centre of Early Music, and conductor Matthew Halls for a roundtable discussion about the future of early music performance in the UK. Also featured in the programme are recordings from this year's York Early Music Festival Young Artists Competition. That's in a couple of minutes after the news read by David Cornett.
The Labour leader Ed Miliband has urged the government to change course on the economy because he believes its austerity measures aren't working. He said the coalition was failing to meet its plans to reduce the budget deficit. Mr Miliband repeated his demand for a temporary cut in VAT to help boost the economy. The government has accused Mr Miliband of making a U-turn by promising that Labour would reduce the cap on tuition fees in England from £9,000 to £6,000. The university's minister, David Willetts, says Mr Miliband's idea looks cynical because his party voted against increases in fees last year. The Greek finance minister, Evangelos Venizelos, is due to meet the head of the International Monetary Fund, Christine Lagarde, in Washington later today to discuss his country's growing debt crisis. Reports suggest that the world's economic leaders have been working on plans to allow Greece to default on some of its debts and remain in the euro. Troops from Libya's National Transitional Council are stepping up their assault on Colonel Gaddafi's hometown of Sirte. They're moving through the desert and along Libya's main coast road. The Metropolitan Police say they're carrying out a thorough and painstaking investigation into a fire which killed a mother of five and her children at their home in northwest London. The blaze is not being treated as suspicious. A sixth child, a 16-year-old girl, remains in critical condition in hospital. Gusty Spence, one of the founders of the Loyalist Ulster Volunteer Force, has died. He was 78. Spence was jailed for the murder of a Catholic civilian in 1966 and became UVF commander in the Mays prison. Sport, there's been another victory for Ireland in the Rugby World Cup. They beat Russia 62-12. But Scotland were narrowly defeated by Argentina 13-12. And the weather. Many places in England and Wales will have a dry, bright and rather warm day, but there's a wet and windy afternoon ahead for Northern Ireland and Scotland, where there could be gale force winds this evening. BBC News and Weather at approaching 3 minutes past one.
And it was read by David Cornett. Well, now on Radio 3, we join Catherine Botts for today's early music show.
Say what you like about the early music movement, it never stands still. The landscape's different for every emerging generation. From the early days, when everyone thought it was all about Krumhorns and Hirtenschalmei, when players were really finding their way into old techniques by trial and error, through the commercial expansion of period instrument playing led by the record companies and the CD revolution, to nowadays, when every music college worth its salt has an ambitious early music department. But what's on offer for the young early musicians of today and tomorrow? To discuss this important question, I'm joined by three knowledgeable and experienced guests. And to emphasise the excellence of today's young performers, all our music today comes from this year's York Early Music Festival Young Artists Competition. So before we talk, let's hear music from the first two finalists in the York competition. The four members of Quadro Melante, Georgia Brown, Bojan Cicic, Ibrahim Aziz and Mahan Esfahani come from Australia, Croatia, Malaysia and Iran, respectively. And they presented a programme of 18th century music inspired by Paris, ending with this by Telemann.
My name is Shani Le Saulnier.
And I am Nadja Le Saulnier.
We formed the harpsichord duo Le Petit Concert Baroque. We are coming from France, but studying in the Schola Cantorum Basiliensis in Switzerland.
We are sisters. We grew up together, we did all our studies and musical life together. Of course, in first we started to play the normal piece wrote for two harpsichords.
But afterwards, we had the opportunity to work with many singers and in many chamber music ensembles in the Schola Cantorum Basiliensis. And we love so much this music.